Welcome to This Week in Lotus. The weekly roundtable discussion of all things social, collaboration, technology and community. Here's your host, Stuart McIntyre.
This Week in Lotus, episode 97, recorded on Monday, 23rd of April, 2012. The Social Student Experience. John Scott joins us to discuss the role of social and collaboration tools in 21st century university teaching. Darren and I ponder the lessons to be learned from lotuslearns.com. All that and more on This Week in Lotus. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. You can find this and other tech-related podcasts at techpodcast.com. Hello and welcome to This Week in Lotus. Here we are for episode 97 of the weekly roundtable discussion about all things Lotus, collaboration, social and everything else that goes with that. Hello, Darren Duke.
Hello, Stuart.
We're back.
Allegedly, we'll see. So episode 100 might occur in 4 weeks, or 4 months, or 4 years. We don't know.
Who knows? We've been so regular through these 2 years of doing these things, and then it slipped a bit in the last month. So apologies to all who were waiting. I only saw one tweet from Nicholas Heidloff saying, when are you going to be back?
Yeah, and you know, it's one of them things. I think it was just a perfect storm of work and vacations and not being in front of decent broadband connections. And, you know, like you said, it was a pretty good run for 96 episodes, and then 97 took a couple of weeks to get past the hiccup.
It did. But we're back and recording, and it will go out very soon. And, of course, we're getting ever closer to episode 100. So I put out a tweet today saying, if you think of anything that we can do to celebrate episode 100, let us know. So same go to you, Dan. If you think of anything we can do, let me know.
Well, I saw someone replied, let's have beers in London, which I guess kind of counts me out.
Yeah, we can't do that. It's got to be something we can all be involved in. So come up with some clever ideas, guys, and let us know on Twitter, and we will follow up on those. So we are back for another episode. We're going to be talking all about education and new folks coming through to the workforce and Gen Y and so on. And it kind of all follows from a session that a good guy called John Scott did at Social Connections version 2. So if you haven't seen that, go search for it on YouTube. And John joins us today. Hi there, John.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you very much. It's great to have you on the show. So thanks for taking part today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. Do you want to tell us what you do?
Officially, I am technically a freelance, but I graduated from the Cardiff School of Biosciences about 2 years ago now, and they took an interest into a project I did, which instead of a lab project, because I did some cancer research as part of my degree, I actually spent some time in my final year focusing on the sort of technological applications we can use in higher education to improve collaboration and student lecture engagement, and obviously started getting into the whole world of online education. And I've been teased into IBM's processes. So I've been working with Simon Vaughan in Cardiff University to help the rollout of Connections 301. So we're looking to do some research and see how students are using this, how we can best use it, get feedback on student expectations and that kind of thing. So it's very busy.
You're not a Liverpool fan, are you?
I'm actually not a football fan.
Oh, good.
I'm one of these people that spends quality time with their friends.
Tweeting and being on Facebook and things like that.
The computer turns off after work.
Good for you. And it's great to have your voice on Twill, because, you know, so many people we speak to on Twill, just like Darren and ourselves, are IT folks. You know, we've been through the IT factory, if you like, for the last, you know, 15, 20 years working on IT projects. It's good to always hear a fresh voice that doesn't come from that kind of area of work coming through. So fantastic you can join us today.
Thanks. Now, my pleasure.
Social Connections, you spoke with Joe Nichols, didn't you, about kind of the needs of folks that are coming through into the workforce. So do you want to talk about some of the work you did as part of this research project you did, and kind of some of the thinking you've been working through around the needs of young folks coming through?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I didn't really have a choice when I started doing my research, because, I mean, the one thing that struck out most from my higher education experience was a kind of lack of connectedness, which doesn't make sense because you're paying to go to an institution. You expect there to be a certain network and a community of learners. And basically, things have changed a lot since the 70s, I learned. And there's a lot of social isolation and the dominance of lectures or didactic teaching, we call it. Is actually quite a big problem in that, because some of these modules that you'll go through have limited resources for running tutorials. And in fact, the only contact you get with your peers and the lecturer is during these lectures, but mostly people stay silent. So what I started doing was trying to think of ways to actually get students more involved with the course, taking more ownership of it, and also starting a dialogue between the students and the lecturers themselves. Because if we're emphasizing that this point of contact is the most important thing in higher education, then surely we need to be doing more to improve that. And in my particular interest, being a geek, was how we can use technology to improve this, but not just technology. It was more of a case of how can we build community and then use the tools to enhance and enrich that communication that's going on. So we've done a series of case studies involving small modules to large modules, and we're learning quite a lot. I'll probably ask you here if you would like to know about any particular aspect of it, because there's a lot going on.
So can you maybe expand on what the collaboration kind of idea is? Because obviously when I went to college, which was many moons ago, and we hammered a tablet with a chisel, and that's how we took notes. what kind of interactivity are they striving for now, or would you like to see in higher education that doesn't exist?
Sure. I wouldn't say it doesn't exist. I'd just say it happens on its own, and it's siloed off and it's not shared. I mean, ultimately it wouldn't have changed. People still go and they read. Some students read more than others. They share their reading, they revise together, they make notes. But most of the time this is based on a lot of a lot of them lack the digital literacies that encompass the ability to share those and reap the benefits of that. So what we're trying to do is encourage the normal collaboration that would happen between students and essentially platform it so that it can be shared within the school. So we've got students sharing notes, sharing papers they're reading, asking questions in Facebook groups if they want feedback on anything on the module or any particular content in the module. But we're trying to get the students themselves to take responsibility and run these things themselves. So they're actually organizing tutorials every week to support, you know, anything that they learn in the lectures, questions they have, and they can share their reading. And we use social annotation technologies like Google Docs, and another one I mentioned I'll mention later as part of my tip is Crocodocs, which is a really simple way to just, you know, rather than just, okay, let's email out this paper I found, it's got some great ideas. It's, you know, how can we get that extra meta layer of learning and share it as best as possible? You start to apply this in different ways to different modules because of obviously each module has its own style and size, and student expectations differ and the level of support differs. So it's not just about getting students to meet up and do this. It's about how can we find each level of support that we can start to establish via technology or otherwise to get this kind of conversation going.
So this may sound like a kind of stupid question, but
No such thing.
Well, if you hang around me long enough, you'll realize that's so true. So with the students taking control themselves, I guess would that mean that maybe the faculty are somewhat part of the problem? And if you kind of ignore them and go around them, you can accelerate the process? Or are the faculty being kind of dragged along kicking and screaming? Or are they skipping along whistling saying, yes, let's do this?
I think you'll see a bit of all of the above, which is why I was talking about the importance of really specializing this kind of activity to each module, because in some circumstances it might be best if you structure it and work it into the curriculum in terms of what students are expected to do for the module, then maybe they're more likely to engage in this kind of thing. In some cases we've had it where no lecture involvement has actually done the trick absolutely fine, students are happy to get on with it and do it. In other cases, I've had reports from student module leaders who are running these things going off to other modules trying to do it, and because the lecturer isn't involved in the process, there's been no support whatsoever from the other students. So there's obviously some sort of responsibility on the institution to recognize this officially and work it into the curriculum, but the level in which you do that is, I think, requires a lot of research and understanding and training before we get there. But what is clear is that some students definitely know how to do these things creatively, and at the moment we don't really have the capacity in the structure of the higher education system, you know, with some great examples here and there that I'm sure you can read about online at JISC or whatever. But
And just to jump in there, John, do you think students get credit for coming up with those clever ways to collaborate and work together? Or is that seen, you know, as kind of diminishing their own personal contribution towards the work they're doing? Because, you know, certainly when I was at uni and school, collaboration was in many ways seen as cheating. You know, the whole idea was you did the work yourself. So do they get credit for coming up with these clever things?
I'd say that the structure and rigidity of exams and coursework definitely don't incentivize students to collaborate and share their ideas, full stop. But I will say, in contrary to that, every student that I've been working with that has been involved in creating this kind of activity hasn't complained about it at all. They find it really beneficial for their revision. It's kind of like writing a blog. You know, sometimes people just use it to kind of synthesize their ideas and work out their thinking. And essentially, by sharing your revision schedule, is just another way of doing that. I don't think many of them have been concerned about worrying if people are going to steal their ideas per se, because at least by having this conversation open and sharing it with everybody can attribute that work to you. Part of that problem is the lack of an official platform for doing that. And therefore, a lot of the lecturers wouldn't recognize students' efforts. So I'd say the recognition isn't as good as it could be. And most of the incentive for the students doing it is either for their own personal development or to meet people on the module who are having the same problems as them and to share their concerns. And I think that's enough really for them. But we have had certain cases of lecturers being quite happy with certain engagement and rewarding prizes like books and things like that. But I certainly think that the university could be doing a lot more to recognize these elite students who are willing to come up with ideas and go that extra mile, you know.
And just to kind of segue a little bit, certainly when I came out of university, if folks wanted to get a job doing anything with computing back in sort of mid-90s, you needed to have a knowledge of IT. You needed to know about programming or computer internals or networking or something along those lines. I'm guessing the world has changed, right? Since now every student knows how to use a laptop, knows how to use a mobile device. Do you think there's any need for graduates to have some kind of recognizable qualification in IT, or to have some kind of recognizable expertise they can show to workforce, or is it just that everybody is assumed to have all of that?
Great questions, and I think it's a good time for those kind of questions at the moment, especially because of Gove's changes to the ICT system in the UK. It might leave us in a bit of a black hole of a curriculum situation. It's a complicated one. I'd say the problem starts off with students needing to know what it is that they're going to need in the workforce. But I think, and given from a survey we've done quite recently, most students feel they get enough IT support. But if you ask students what it is they want, if they need support, or what it is they need to know, or what they want to improve, they actually just talk of the basic applications, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. Maybe sending emails if you're lucky. They don't recognize the opportunity for using social media for non-social for methods. And maybe that's part of the problem is that students aren't being exposed to that enough from a sort of educational and professional point of view. But part of the problem, I'd say, we'd have to highlight is the lack of knowledge of what businesses are doing with social technologies, and therefore the expectations that might be required of them. But that's also a problem in the within businesses themselves. Are they being clear enough to what their employees require? Because if we start saying nice and loud and clear that we need employers with the ability to do, you know, various new digital literacies and skills that we didn't once expect 20 years ago, then the universities and schools will have to start recognizing it as a curriculum responsibility. I think it's a perfectly good idea. For example, if you can imagine going back to general studies, I didn't have to take it, but I knew plenty of people that resented taking it and had to do it. But what if that we integrated into something like general studies the ability to, exploring digital literacy, such as understanding, you know, global networks online and engaging with different cultures and using tech computers in a new way, but related to the topics in general studies. Am I making sense? So
yeah, definitely.
It's more about integrating it as a standard practice and an expectation. And that can really help, I think, students to start understanding the impact of that these things might have on their future. But maybe they're not mature enough to realize that then at that stage. So that's why it's important at university.
And it might not be the students who are mature enough. It might be the technologies, right? Sure. If you're doing a 4-year degree now, these days, the technology when you go in is going to be invariably a lot different than the technology when you come out, at least from the social media standpoint, maybe not from the normal mauve-coloured PC, beige-coloured PC kind of idea. So, you know, I kind of feel for the students and for the universities is what do you try and tackle first in order to not hobble a student but actually accelerate the student? And I think it's a thin line because you picked the wrong technology and you've just spent 4 years with 150 students a year and accidentally trained them on something that's completely useless now.
Absolutely, which I suppose emphasizes the importance of concentrating on digital literacies and skills as opposed to tools, because the tools change, the skills don't. You can just use them in different ways. So if we start to come up with some sort of general dialogue on, I mean, these kind of conversations are happening all around the UK and the world. In particular, in Cardiff University has just been, I think they're about a year into their project now. It's a JISC-funded project to investigate how we can implement digital literacies across the board for every stakeholder in university. And that's a project run by Joy Head and Joe Nichols, which I highly recommend checking out. But they're essentially trying to from the baseline, work out what does digital literacy mean to the different schools and how can we start to employ it? It's a big question.
And Darren, maybe kind of chucking it over to you on the other side of the fence as an employer, if you were recruiting, you know, some kind of graduate trainee into STS right now, what would you be looking at, you know, in terms of evidence that they were technically astute enough to join your business?
Ooh, there's a loaded question. You know, we've went round and round on this for a couple of years, and I think all employers do about tweaking things like, you know, tests, and that's always been kind of hard for us because the technology morphs 1 year to another, so or any of them tests would kind of be a bit superfluous. But what I did find interesting is many years ago, probably about 10 years ago now, I used to work for a company called Eagle Technology Consultants in Atlanta. And they had probably about 27 to 30 consultants. And we all, we all did a personality traits test. And it was interesting to see all of the good people had almost the same personality traits as the other good people, with maybe one letter out of the four. I can't remember what the test was, but you get like an A, a C, a G, and an F, or something like that.
So it's like the big five.
Yeah, kind of something like that. And it was interesting to me to see that the people who really gave a rat's ass and knew what they were talking about and would turn up on time all had the same traits. And it wasn't necessarily technical skill-oriented. It seemed that the ones with the right traits could pick up the correct skills over time. And that's kind of where we concentrate more these days, is finding the right personality type for the job, not necessarily the technical skills. Because the problem we have with technical skills today is you can sit down, read a book, pass a test, and then claim you know something. And there is no way for us to know if that test is legitimate or not. Now, coming out of university, I honestly don't expect grad students to know very much, except maybe correct grammar and reading and writing, and Lisa's probably laughing at us as she's listening to it because I'm the worst grammar person on the planet. But that's one of the problems we have in the US, is the US higher education system is honestly so bad that they spend a couple of years teaching 18-year-olds correct grammar and reading and writing and writing in a third person. And so they don't really have a lot of time to pick up any other useful skills. And when they pop out the end, you know, you're lucky if they could write a proposal. And that's the travesty we've got in the US right now. It's not necessarily technical literacy. I think we're a long way from digital literacy. I think we need to get them to normal English literacy before we get there.
Well, you can explore them at the same time, which is, you know, the benefit of good pedagogy. So, but a lot of the things you're saying are really definitely mirrored in my experience of students doing this kind of thing in higher education, because the personality types, as you're saying, it's not the technical skill. It's the openness to wanting to do this. It's the ones that turn up. It's the ones that want to share, the ones that come up with questions, and the ones that are willing to go and learn how to do things on the internet rather than just claim to know it all. And I'd say that the biggest problem, I mean, probably from within business as well, is that we don't really have many mechanisms to recognize this kind of activity unless we're really trying to do things on a more social platform that recognizes this sort of thing. So
it's an interesting challenge, isn't it? I liked what you said earlier on about teaching students, you know, the expertise they need versus the tools they might use to use that expertise, if you like. And, you know, I'm seeing it a lot with, I've got teenage kids in school, and they're very much taught how to do A, B, and C in PowerPoint, in Word, in Excel. And I just look at it with my head in my hand, thinking that can't be the right way to be teaching, the workers of tomorrow, given that those technologies probably won't be around when they reach the workforce. You know, and I know we shouldn't necessarily be teaching kids, just the skills they need to be able to get by or whatever. But I do think it's all about how they learn and how they accomplish the tasks they need to accomplish versus the technologies that are around today that might get them there. So, from my point of view, I wish they were teaching them far more in terms of, you know, some of the options around what tools they might use or why they might choose one tool versus another, versus just saying, you know, click here, click there, click the other, particularly in technologies that I don't necessarily see being around in 5 years' time when they do actually hit the workforce. Mm. So, John, moving on again, one of the things that you mentioned in your talk in Cardiff was around how universities kind of portray themselves as being very social learning environments, but how actually the reality doesn't really match up to that. And I certainly remember from my university days, sat in enormous lecture theatres, you know, full of 800, 1,000 people, looking down at one professor talking, scribbling on a whiteboard, not really asking any questions or getting any feedback back, everybody writing their own notes but not sharing those. Has anything substantially changed in that model, or is it that you would like to see it change in the future?
The whiteboard's gone. That's mostly the case. I mean, some courses are really great at trying to get dialogue in lectures, and some types of learning lend themselves to that really well. For example, in the humanities, where learning is very much dialogue based anyway. But there seems to be, I suppose it's a cultural thing, but people are very shy to ask questions on science courses. Obviously, my background, I know for sure. I can't speak for the others, but I think one thing we can start to work towards is, I want to get my point across clearly here, is that I don't think there's anything wrong with lectures. I think that the thing that's wrong with lectures is that it's the only method of delivering information. That's not the case. A lecture by default is just a time and a place for a group of students and a learned person to turn up and interact. And I think that's what we need to focus on, is that the lecture doesn't have to be a didactic experience. It can be an exchange. I mean, if you start to use more technology in a lecture, that doesn't have to mean that we just imagine, you know, 1,000 students all sitting on their laptops writing individual notes and going off and maybe sharing them. We're talking about how can we use social tools and collaborative technologies to actually enhance the dialogue between students and lecturers during that process. And at the moment, we don't really have the infrastructure at all, or we're nowhere near it in the UK, in fact. But in the States, this is definitely realizable. you know, for example, what, rather than having a 60-minute lecture or 90-minute lecture, couldn't you have a 30-minute lecture, a break, and then maybe a 20-minute group exercise where everybody online is writing on one particular thing and has to contribute to the whole? And that's definitely something that can go on from lecture to lecture, as opposed to just within the one lecture. So that's kind of the way I envisage it.
So earlier on, you said there was a lack of tooling or a platform. You know, we've got things like Moodle and Blackboard, but they're more for coursework kind of ideas. What kind of tooling is missing? And I'll ask the pointed question, could connections fill that void?
Good question. Moodle and Blackboard, I'd probably say, are, by definition, they're called virtual learning environments, but they're more virtual teaching environments. There's not really much exchange that goes on. And obviously, you know, don't get me wrong, Blackboard and Moodle both have collaborative tools, but I'm not so sure the standards of those tools are quite up to what, you know, the Gen Yers would come to expect from the internet. You know, websites are supposed to feel alive and there and fresh and ready and easy to use and quick and clean and easily organized and obvious. But we don't see that in the traditional virtual learning environments. So there's obviously a niche for collaboration technologies in higher education, but which do you use? Can you use external tools such as Facebook? There's loads of issues with using Facebook, and we've tried a few workarounds to get lecturers anonymously involved in that, but it's not been designed from an educational point of view. Ironically, obviously it was in the first place, but it's gone all right. But there is a big niche for educational tools created by educators, and there are a few developments in that. Connections is a very interesting space. I mean, the funny thing about connections, and I'll be frank, is that because it comes from a business background, it has a long way to come before it's going to be very easy to 60, 70 year old professors to click on and go, all right, obviously I can do this. But with the updates coming in Connections 4, I think we're going to really start to see the advantages of using a platform like Connections as an internal collaboration solution. I don't know if you want to break that down a bit. I don't know where to carry on from there.
So is it about functionality, or is it about sort of it's not intuitive enough for some of those professors and so on to take on?
Intuitiveness, I suppose. Functionality, it has lots of tools, but I think the problem is when you go on connection, it's definitely 2.5, but even 3.01, it can be confusing as to, if I want to share a piece of information, unless I know the system well enough, i.e. what each specific tool does, how the sharing functions work, how which ones I can recommend and which ones I can't, it's not obvious to the user how to share information. In contrast that to Facebook, for example, you go on a Facebook group, as soon as you paste the link in, it will automatically capture it and stick it in a box for you, and you can go and carry on writing about it. Or it might automatically embed a video, for example, and all you have to do is press enter and it's gone. So contrast that simplicity to the experience of connections, and I think you'll start to understand why a lot of educators and students who are used to things like Blackboard might shy away from that kind of technology. So it really does need to be as intuitive as possible.
And I think that's been IBM's Achilles heel for decades, is the intuitiveness and the simplicity of use and being able to pick up a tool and just hit the nail on the head with the hammer. That never has been IBM's Ballywick, and they probably would completely ignore me and Stuart if we said it, but I'm betting there's a few ears perking up now that John said this.
I think you're right, Darren. I think you're right, and it's certainly something I've heard from users and so on that I've worked with, is that it needs to be easier, and some of that Facebook style sharing, you know, whilst we all have criticisms of Facebook, and Darren, I know you're not even on there as a user, so you've also got your reasons for not being, but whilst we all have our issues with Facebook, I think some of the ease of sharing is clearly something that we could definitely copy with all of the collaboration tools we use, not just Notes and Connections and so on, but you know, I'm sure Microsoft could as well. I think the consumer web is teaching the enterprise web a huge amount about the ease of sharing, the ease of use, the ease of learning of all of these tools, and I think Google Plus is taking that maybe even a step further in terms of making some of this stuff just so easy to do.
And I don't think it has to be seen as a disadvantage that we're trying to, you know, copy that type of feel and functionality, because essentially what we have with Facebook, and it's very clear that it's become the easiest tool to use to kind of get student feedback on the go during a module. But the problem has been once you do a poll and you find out how many students want a tutorial on X, Y, or Z, it's still very difficult as the educator to go and organize that. So what we're asking here now is, if Connections had that kind of functionality and it was built specifically for educational purposes with certain widgets and applets, et cetera, and maybe external connections into it, how much more benefit there could be to that, to have it designed around, you know, an educator, a student. For example, it could be really easy to just extract the number of people who have liked a post about wanting a particular tutorial and to churn that list of people that have liked it into organizing a wiki for you from a template, which, you know, you can't do that kind of thing at the moment. And I think those are the kind of things we need to realize before educators are going to see the real benefit of social collaboration tools.
And Darren, just to jump in on that suggestion by John, do you remember back in the old workplace days, there was workplace for banking and workplace for retail and so on? Do you see that as something that IBM ever should go back to, in terms of there being connections for academia or connections for charities or whatever it might be, in terms of making them a little bit more customized? Or do you see that as being a business partner that might want to jump into that void?
I think there's definitely a need for it. The problem with being a business partner and doing it is, once IBM steps into that arena, your little cockroach has just been squished by the big giant. And so I think it's going to take a lot of investment to find out. And the other problem I see with IBM doing it, actually, is IBM would want one size fits all. Here's the education thing, go. And that's not necessarily true. I think education is different in all the continents, just by their disparate geographic nature.
Let alone all the schools within an education system.
Exactly.
Differently. Yeah.
So trying to standardize on that, I think, is difficult. But like we mentioned earlier, people like Moodle and Blackboard have kind of at least made inroads to that. And I think if you make it flexible enough, and this is where Connections as a platform conversation comes back up, if they were to make it flexible enough that the widgets could be designed reasonably easily, yet be highly functional, then a business partner, or indeed the education establishment themselves, could take the basis of that and build it. But I still think Connections as a platform is still a long way off.
I think you could be right. I think there's still work to go there. And the other issue, and I found this a lot with customizing Connections, is that from version to version, it changes so much that if a business partner did jump in and fulfill that void, then, you know, there needs to be guarantees that customization is still going to work in future versions as well. And John, moving on again, you know, something that very noticeable walking around a university, as I do, occasionally at Cardiff and other places, is the rise of mobile devices. I mean, if we think that mobile has taken over in the workplace in enterprise corporations, then, you know, it's only done that and much, much more in academia. Every student has their smartphone, and it tends to be, I see, as one of the major interfaces they use. Do you still think that, you know, the Windows or Mac desktop is still the leading way that people access some of these systems, or do you think mobiles are becoming the primary device of choice?
I'd actually have to say my experience has contrasted yours quite a lot. Okay. From especially final year students, when it comes down to doing the nitty-gritty, doing their revision, they don't use mobile devices. The likelihood is they're in a place that has either a decent PC or they've got their laptop on them, and they'd much rather highlight a bit of reading on paper and maybe write some notes on Microsoft Word than to be reading notes on a small screen. But that isn't to say that mobile learning doesn't have any potential. I think it's just being seen from the sort of wrong perspective at the moment. At the moment, I think it's great for people starting off at university, getting to know the campus, you know, realizing where their resources can be accessed. But I think part of the problem here is, again, the rigidity of the systems that we've got that students are using these for mobile learning. So, for example, Blackboard Learn doesn't provide any extra functionality to the Blackboard system. It's simply just a way of viewing your lecture notes from a mobile device. And I'm not really sure why, if I was a student in any year, I'd want to be reading that on a small screen as opposed to having my notes in front of me and a big A3 page to do a mind map. So to realize the potential of mobile learning, we need to start seeing more useful collaboration tools. So on my iPad, if I went on Blackboard Learn, could I open a doc with everyone simultaneously and start making diagrams on the fly? Or could I share my questions and concerns instantly in a Facebook-style fashion? And I think that's when we'll see mobile learning really take rise. But at the moment, I don't really think it's that important to many students. Does that surprise you? I'm not sure.
I guess it probably does. I mean, I imagined we'd be a little bit further down the road now in terms of you know, for example, being in a lecture and somebody, you know, and the lecturer wants to take a poll of the students and everybody, you know, getting out their iPhone or their Android or whatever and being able to vote on something or suggest things. I just imagine that we'd be a bit further down. I guess in terms of revision and studying long term, I can only imagine that in, you know, 3 or 4 years, everybody will have the textbooks on the Kindle or on their iPad.
Sure.
and will have moved away from buying, you know, £20 or $30 textbooks, you know, for each student, etc. So I would have thought we're on that road. But as you say, maybe it's still the large screens, proper keyboards and so on are the way to go for doing those sort of tougher tasks.
And you have to remember as well, of course, sometimes, as you say, tougher tasks, you know, I wouldn't dare try and edit a database and do some statistics on an iPad. And a lot of the time, students are having to switch and multitask between these kind of things. And they just want to get it done, essentially. Yeah.
One last question just before we move on. How widely do you think things like Twitter and so on are used in student environment? I mean, again, we would imagine that Facebook and Twitter and so on are pretty much ubiquitous across. Do you still think it's quite early adopters amongst the student population that are using all these social tools, or do you think it really has reached widespread usage?
Twitter's definitely becoming more popular, but I'm not sure how many people are using it to help them collaborate academically. And part of the problem, again, is the lack of institutional commitment to this kind of thing, because, I mean, the way higher education institutions work is, and this is definitely the view on research, is that even if there's 20% of students that don't have smartphones, then that's not enough. We can't have that as a policy, because what about the other 20%? So therefore, we can't say to lecturers, you should be using a live feed in your lecture to answer questions, etc. That's a big problem, and that's what's slowing us down, I think.
And of course, in universities, a lot of pressure, I should imagine, for students to copy other people's work and a lot of work done by lecturers and universities to make sure that doesn't happen. It's been a bit of a tempest in a teacup in the Lotus community, Darren, this week around some of that copying of content. What have you kind of learned from following the whole Lotus Learns discussion?
I found out about it after the fact, because I've been kind of out of pocket for a week. It's interesting that people still think that they can copy verbatim content, put it on some site, and not attribute it to the original author, and not eventually be found out about it. But then take that a stage further, that taking content from multiple different authors all at the same time and not attributing them is just going to accelerate that finding you out. And, you know, I don't know exactly what went on with Lotus Learns. The site's gone down, so I have no idea what it was about. But a bit of detective work makes me think it was African or something. And the rationale behind that was because people in Africa don't have the bandwidth to get to the real blogs in Australia or Europe or the US, which sounds more, it sounds like more than fishy. It sounds like it's a blatant disregard and trying to come up with an excuse instead of a reason. The site's down. That's apparently what I think the ire of the Lotus community was about this weekend, that there was at least, 10 to 12 Planet Lotus blogs, one after the rabbit. So there was obviously some kind of planned demonstration here. And I think the interesting outcome here is if Lotus Learns was just aggregating the content verbatim, they were also going to aggregate the content about Lotus Learns being thieves. So I think it's interesting from a recursive standpoint here about the outcome. But as soon as it looks to me like as soon as the site started posting stuff about the site being bad, the site went down.
I think they've been complaining to Google about blogger.com, so I think that was the reason it went down.
Okay. So either way, it looks like you know, it's over, it's done with. But when you take something, no matter how small, no matter how big, you should really attribute it to the original author. It doesn't matter if the author was 2,000 years old or the post was from 2 hours ago. You should still attribute what you have gained from other people. And in this world, at least online, treat others as you would expect to be treated yourself. So if someone came and stole your stuff, how would you feel? And that's the way I kind of try and do it.
And something I found very interesting, it's clearly there are sites that aggregate content from around the community and do so with everybody's goodwill. You know, Planet Lotus does effectively what Lotus Learns did. It still has advertising on, just like Lotus Learns did as well. But because of the way Yancy went about it, basically asking people to promote their own blogs to it and you know, and giving the option to take them off again and so on, and clearly having links to those sites, it's dealt with in a very different way. So I think, you know, Lotus Learns went down a very interesting route. And I think part of the problem, as you point out, Darren, is that very fishy reason for doing it didn't help them at all, particularly as, you know, the site was pretty graphic heavy, had loads of ads and so on. So the whole idea of doing it for low bandwidth connections around Africa just didn't stack up. So I think hopefully nobody else will go down the route of copying data. And the other thing is I just can't see what benefit it gave them. I can't imagine the ad traffic was high enough to justify the ire that it stoked up in people. And I can't believe that they got a huge number of Google hits from it. So I just don't quite understand the motivation for going down that route. But hopefully it won't happen again in the future.
And if you do want a low bandwidth, if you're at a low bandwidth connection, or even on a small surface device, m.planetlotus.org.
Yeah.
For the mobile version, which is very, very lightweight.
Very good tip. Use that all the time. And just to wrap up for the week, John, I believe you're taking part again in Social Connections version 3, which is coming up in June. You're going to be out there in Dublin?
Woohoo! Yes, you got it. Sounds great. I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait to have the opportunity again to meet and connect with all of the IBM partners and associates and interesting minds. I got some great feedback last time. I'm really looking forward to seeing how people react to what I've got to give again, see how things have developed. I think it's probably a bit more pessimism on my part from, but maybe that's because Cardiff University haven't paid me for so long.
nudge.
But yeah, it should be great.
That would build pessimism right there. So I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that obviously Social Connections dictates the team that's going to do the Grand Slam.
So, okay.
That would mean the Irish are going to do the Grand Slam in the next Six Nations.
That won't please Mr. Vaughan at all. We'll see if the model stacks up on that. Interesting thoughts. The date for everybody, if you're interested, Social Connections version 3 is on the 22nd of June in Dublin at the IBM Lab. So if you want to find out more about that, we're accepting abstracts. So do take a look, particularly if you want to speak and want to present on IBM Connections or anything that's related to the kind of social collaboration sphere. It's a great way to get some experience before you then go on to present at UK Lug or Lotusphere even. So we'd love to have some names from outside the traditional kind of Lotus bubble. So do take a look at socialconnections.info. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to move on to tips. Darren, what's your tip for this week?
Seeing as I'm the only one with one tip, I'm going to add a second tip in a second. When I'm using my Google Android devices, I really miss the reader functionality from my iPhone that can take a web page and basically extract the body and present it in somewhat of an ebook feel and look like it's readable and usable. And I always missed that on my G-Shinies. So I went digging a bit and I found that Dolphin HD Browser, which is a freely available browser, has a plugin called Dolphin Reader that does the exact same thing on Google devices. So I would go and get that soon before Apple realizes this and sues the pants off Dolphin. So that's number one tip. It's very good. It really does translate a really complicated web page into just standard text that you can read just like an ebook. And then number two, while on the further education, higher education kind of idea, last week in the US, Coursera launched, which is a startup initiative between Stanford and a lot of other high-end schools. For some reason, I forgot. Princeton, I think, is another one of them. And basically, they're offering courses, their entire courses, online for free. So you can sign up and take one of these Ivy League school courses for absolutely free. There's four or five universities involved. You don't get course credit, so you can't get a degree out of this, but they will grade you. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes from this point on. And what kind of caught my attention is the first couple of courses are computer related. I think there's like machine learning, computer science 101, and then the one that I used to dread way back in the day when I was at university was compilers. I'll never understand compilers.
Oh, I should have a look at that. It sounds like some really good courses on there. We'll have the link in the show notes. Do go and check that out. And John, what's your tip?
I'll have to second Darren's recommendation. Coursera is fantastic. I've signed up to about five already. I'm really looking forward to that. And I think it will be really interesting to see how they use social and collaborative technologies to enhance the student experience, because I think it would really lend itself well to that. So on to my tip. So the first one, pretty simple, but I've been doing some reading about social annotation technologies, and I've had some experience with them with myself for using Google Docs and stuff instead of just doing comments on Word. And if you want, looking to get someone into this, be it a group or for training purposes, I highly recommend CrocoDoc. It's really easy to set up, it's easy to use, and you can straight away see how it would benefit learners. And just to add to that, from my reading, apparently, and you might find this interesting, but social annotation tools have proven to increase participation and engagement, improve instruction, promote attention, communication, and organization, and can even improve reading comprehension and peer critiquing skills, which is fantastic. So
does it solve world hunger as well?
Well, collaboration might. Let's see. Let's get a game. And the second tip, slight contrast. I know you might be confused to this, but I promise it will make sense. So I'd like to ask, do your kids or significant others keep asking you every month for new and expensive computer games to play? Because they keep coming out and they're all the same. So recently there's been a game that's come out called Tribes Ascend. It's free to play and it's great fun. It's very rewarding. It's original. So it's good to play. But the reason I'm giving this to you now is because I think this is a fantastic idea. If the game's free and you can, let's say your kids are addicted to computer games and you can't get them to do their homework, how about £3 for that super awesome gun or upgrade they want? And that's great for a positive learning experience. You could use it to incentivize some a hard day's work or meeting a deadline. And it's cheap and it's good fun. I highly recommend playing it.
I think it's funny that when you say incentivize, I hear blackmail.
The greatest thing is that you're not buying anything physical. It's a genius business plan, really, to buy gold on a fake economy so you can have a virtual tool.
I'm not sure about the do well, be good, and I'll buy you a gun idea. I'm not sure that quite stacks up, but there we go.
That'll work well in America, actually.
Yeah, that will go down very well. And my tips this week, I've got a few as well. First of all, if you're looking to do any demos from iOS devices, people that I've seen have been using the sort of modeler that comes as part of the SDK, but the problem is that only works with inbuilt apps. It doesn't work with any third-party apps. There is a new app for the Mac called Reflection App, and what that does is basically it makes your Mac into a AirPlay device that your iPad or iPhone can mirror its screen onto. And so it's a fantastic way of being able to demo any third-party apps that support mirroring, which is basically pretty much anything apart from TV apps, pretty much. So do check that out. It's reflectionapp.com. I think it's $15 to buy. And the other thing is, if you're a cord cutter and you want to cut down on the amount you spend on cable, I do understand there's this thing called torrent out there. I've never used it personally, obviously, to download any kind of TV shows. But if you did do that, there's a really great app called TED, which is the Torrent Episode Downloader. And it basically watches TV episodes that come up on torrents and downloads them automatically for you. So you can subscribe to, I don't know, CSI or Deadliest Catch or whatever, and it'll just download all the latest episodes. If you do watch torrents, which you might do, then that's an option for you. And last thing on iOS, if you want to subscribe to Sky Sports, if you're in the UK, there's now an option on the iPhone or iPad to subscribe to Sky Sports, which is £5 a month, which is a whole lot cheaper than getting a Sky Dish. So all good tips if you're in that kind of area and interested. So all the links are in the show notes. Do check those out. And that is This Week in Loads for this week. So, John, thank you so much for taking part.
Thank you very much.
To have you on the show. Do you have a Twitter account or blog that you can direct people to?
Yep, it's at John Scott, JONSC0TT, and you can find me there. Fantastic. Always ready to chat.
Awesome. Great to have you on. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
Darren, how do people find you?
Blog.darrenduke.net for all things technical, and Darren Duke, all one word, for my protestations at Domino Configuration Tuner hasn't been updated since February of 2011.
And I saw you up on Hot Blogs in the last couple of weeks.
What? On Planet
Lotus. You were. A brief appearance. So keep that blogging up. And I am Stuart McIntyre. You can find me on Twitter at Stuart McIntyre or on the blog at blog.collaborationmatters.com. And having taken a 3-month holiday from blogging with just the occasional post, I'm trying to get back into it again. So do keep an eye on Planet Lotus for my latest news. So with that, we are done for this week. Do listen out for This Week in Lotus 98, hopefully sometime soon. Thank you so much for listening. This was This Week in Lotus. Bye.
All opinions expressed during this podcast are those of the participants only and do not necessarily represent those of their employer.